Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the People Power Politics Podcast, brought to you by CEDAW, the Center for Elections, Democracy, Accountability and Representation at the University of Birmingham. Hi everyone, and thanks for joining us. I am Licia Cianetti, Deputy Director of CEDAW, and I'm your host today. I am delighted to welcome to the podcast two of my great colleagues here at the University of Birmingham, Charlotte Galpin and Verena Brandl. So Charlotte Galpin is Senior Lecturer in German and European Politics. She's currently working on a book on British national identity and the gendered underpinnings of the Brexit debate. But she also works on the European public sphere, media representation, and the impact of social media, which will be the focus of this episode. Verena Brandl is Assistant Professor in Political Science and International Studies. She is also a specialist in European politics, and her research focuses on the democratic implications of social media, political communication, and digital migration studies. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Perfect. So the topic of our conversation today is social media and their impact on democracy. Now, given your geographical specialism, we will be talking primarily about European democracies, but I believe that many of the points that we will touch upon have wider implications also beyond Europe. So now, the context for this conversation is that for the past 15 years, we've changed quite a bit the way in which we talk about social media. So we went from this kind of dreamscape of social media that we were expecting to democratize political communication, to enable more egalitarian, horizontal sharing of information, and allow for this kind of more efficient citizen participation, to this kind of techno-dystopian hellscape where social media are fragmenting society, are facilitating hyper-polarization, spreading misinformation, disinformation, and basically contributing to the erosion of democracy. So to get us started, I'd like to ask you, what do you think is the role of social media in democracy today? And what would you say is the main challenge that social media poses to democracy? So maybe Charlotte, do you want to start?
Yeah, I think when we're talking about social media and democracy, there's a tendency to talk about social media as separate from democracy, and then we measure causal impact on democracy. But really, we're in a situation today where we can't separate social media from democracy. It's an arena where democracy is happening, but then where politicians and candidates are looking for votes, but it's also social media companies are actors in a way. And so you have causal arrows going in all directions. And so I think regardless of whether you're on the positive side of that discussion or the negative side, actually that it's where we are today, and we have to find some way to deal with these challenges.
So the problem is that since social media and politics is so inseparable, we still struggle with saying, is this a good thing? Is it a bad thing? It's both. I mean, I started my PhD right after the Arab Spring, the uprisings, where there was a lot of hope and scholars were very hopeful that social media would really democratize a lot of areas around the world. And now democracies are particularly struggling because of social media potentially, but also because we don't really know how politics works as something that happens on social media right now. So I have a lot to say about this because I'm struggling as well about trying to figure out, so what is the role of social media? It hasn't created something completely new, the way we do politics, but on the other hand, there are many things that we did before in politics that are now just amplified, and it's very difficult to say, okay, well, this is new because of social media, or this is something that we've always done, and the question is, does it actually matter, or do we actually just need to come up with some solutions or some ways to measure these concepts in a better, more appropriate way, maybe?
One thing that I've been working on is this issue of online abuse, and that's become the topic of conversation around the level of abuse, particularly women or racialized people receive online, and the implication that that has for their ability to participate. So if we take the Brexit debates after the referendum, there was an extraordinary amount of volume of abuse that was directed at particularly women MPs that were contributing to Brexit debates, including death and rape threats, all kinds of misogynistic and racist abuse. And you had 18 women MPs step down in 2019, and many of them citing this kind of abuse. But what's kind of really interesting and also important to remember is that this is not a new thing that women in public life face misogyny. The form has changed. And there's a speech by Diane Abbott in Parliament a few years ago, and she was the first black woman MP to be elected, I think, in the 80s. And she talks about how it's the form that's changed and also the volume, but the messages are reminiscent to what she was receiving via letter and telephone and back in the 80s and through the 90s. So there's a little bit of a danger, I think, that we kind of focus so much on social media but ignore the embeddedness within these wider structures.
Yeah, and thanks for bringing that up, because it was actually my next question, because the way I read your work, of both of you, is that you both point to the fact that to understand the effects of social media on democracy, we cannot separate the two, as Bruno was saying, and we must actually look at the interface between online and offline. These are not two separate spheres, but are interpenetrating. So what happens on social media, the filter bubbles, the abuse, the disinformation, but also potentially, you know, emancipatory, transnational mobilization, is in a two-way relationship with what happens offline, and the actors involved navigate and sometimes exploit this interface. So I guess starting with you, Charlotte, and continuing on what you were already starting to talk about, there's an article you published 2 years ago in Politics and Governance where you looked at the online experiences of already marginalized groups. And you argue that, and I'm quoting from you here, that to fully understand the impact of social media on European democracy, we need to pay attention to gendered and racialized dynamics of power within the digital public sphere that have unequal consequences for democratic participation. So in a way, I want you to expand on it. What do you mean by that? And what does it mean for how we should understand social media and democracy?
Yes, if we go back to what Verena said earlier about this kind of period of optimism around the role of social media, that was kind of my starting point in engaging with literature, particularly around EU politics and the possibilities for social media to facilitate that kind of engagement with EU European politics, and to then create a kind of engaged European demos. And I found a lot of this literature incredibly positive about this, what's described as participatory promise of social media, that the social media would kind of really facilitate engagement with European democracy. But none of it really kind of addressed what that engagement would look like for people from marginalized or minoritized groups. And if we start to kind of ask specific questions about what it's like to engage in politics as a woman of color, as a queer person, as a trans woman, as a migrant, whatever different kind of particular location, then you have a very different experience online, and that a lot of that is shaped by that experience of online abuse, which, drawing on Nancy Fraser, I'm calling participatory inequality, that this is a kind of form of silencing of particular voices in public debates. But then there are certain opportunities that social media brings for minoritized groups around. Social media removed the gatekeepers of traditional media that has allowed for mobilization, social groups to come together to have a voice and engage in what's become kind of talked about as digital counterpublics. So on the flip side, those counterpublics are also shaped by kind of exclusions and other kinds of marginalization. So there are all these kind of nuances that we can take into account.
Yeah, so the power dynamics that we have in society would be replicated and potentially amplified in social media. So, Verena, just to bring your work in here, your work illuminates a different aspect of this interface between online and offline, and between the informal and formal actors that inhabit these spaces. So in some recent work on migration information campaigns, you looked at how certain European governments have used online campaigns through social media to dissuade people from migrating to Europe. And you show that while this is an online practice and it spreads through social media via a variety of online actors, it is also part of, very offline in a way, government's migration governance, and it contributes to setting the stage for, and I would say also normalizing, increasing levels of border violence in Europe. So we're used to thinking about how populists weaponize the post-factual relativism that comes with social media and fake news. You know, nothing is true, everything is true, and, you know, I'm entitled to my own opinions, but also to my own facts kind of dynamics. But your work seems to show that that's not only the remit of populists, but that non-populist governments also exploit this kind of post-truth condition. So what does this mean for how we understand the post-truth condition and the role of democratic governments in responding to it, but also in shaping it?
Yeah, that's a good question. When I looked at these migration campaigns, I looked first at the goals. So what are the declared objectives of these campaigns? What do governments say they want to do? And I looked specifically at democratically elected governments, and you find that they all say, and you know, it's not just like specific governments. Sometimes these campaigns are also outsourced to other actors, such as the International Organization for Migration, an international organization. So you have all of these actors say, we have an interest that migrants don't risk their lives on these very, very dangerous journeys. And then you look at the content of the campaigns, and you just really wonder how that would help their objective. Because so what we know about these migration campaigns is that they usually don't work. We can't just provide people with information and then they stop doing things that they do for completely different reasons than what governments and governmental actors think they do. So if we think about, you know, why people migrate, you can't just say, it's dangerous, don't come. People have different reasons. They know it's dangerous. So governments completely underestimate the knowledge that people have when they migrate. They completely underestimate the decisions they make. They think it's irrational. You know, you want a better life, but it's often they actually flee from difficult situations. And there's this entire claiming that once you're a governmental actor, once you have these goals, that you actually are an authority and know the truth. And that is not really the case. So in these migration campaigns are really slippery, because in a way there's not really any factual issues in these campaigns. There's no lies in there. There's no disinformation in there, but the way they're framed, they're basically just reiterating policies as natural facts that cannot be changed. So this really hinders actual change. And they're just, governments are actors that communicate in their own interests. So in a sense, shouldn't have been surprised about this. They have their own objectives. Don't know if that answers the question, but yeah, that's something that we often underestimate.
And I think that brings us to this, the whole slippery grey wall between a clear disinformation and then different ways of framing.
Yeah.
That this is not new to social media, right? This is kind of part of media and media representation in general. So is there anything new that social media bring to the table of disinformation, misinformation, framing and kind of ways that hide part of the reality? In the case of your study, hide the fact that those journalists are more and more perilous because they're made so by policy.
I think what social media do especially is that they multiply voices. And coming back to the optimistic view, in a sense, it was like, yeah, we give, finally people have the voice that usually don't have a voice. But that also means that the social media are not a tool for good. They haven't been designed to be, to do good in the world. They're economic interests behind business interests. So all sorts of actors can use social media. And all of a sudden you have this mix of information and news and maybe disinformation, misinformation that you have to navigate. And I think that's incredibly hard. And I think that is something that social media has definitely added to the picture.
I mean, the work that I've done on post-truth politics, we're kind of quite clear that we're not imagining like a completely new era of post-truth that can be contrasted with like a golden age of truth, because we know that there's always been disinformation in the public sphere that's come from governments, it comes from newspapers, particularly around gender, sexual, and racial minorities. This has always been a facet of democracy and democratic and non-democratic regimes. Yeah, I think what is new about social media is we now speak of like a hybrid media landscape. So we don't just have social media on the one hand and kind of traditional legacy news on the other, but we now have a hybrid landscape where legacy media kind of rely on social media and vice versa, and you can't really easily separate them. And I think one thing that's happened is that it's changed the nature of the news. So previously, newspapers could rely on kind of the brand of the newspaper to sell newspapers. What's happened now is that they are reliant on clicks that are achieved through individual stories. So each individual story that's published in news needs to kind of aim at generating clicks. That leads to advertising revenue for news organizations. And that means that stories or journalists, editors need to orient themselves around a social logic of news in terms of how many clicks is this going to generate? Is this going to get shared? Is it going to get liked? Is it going to get commented on? And what's happened is that encourages legacy news to publish stories that are sensationalist, whip up anger, or also sadness, or so things that can be or provoke emotion. And what that does is then encourage the kind of stories that aren't necessarily factual or are framed in particularly sensationalist ways. And it has also changed how the very business models of legacy newspapers, because they can't rely on print sales anymore, they're very reliant on clicks. This means that journalists are under a lot more pressure to publish a lot more stories a lot more quickly. And that has lowered the possibility for fact-checking, for traditional professional kind of journalism where you go and you investigate a story, you go and interview people, you double-check your facts. So part of social media's impact is not just on what gets circulated by kind of nefarious actors, but also what it's done to those traditional sources of trusted information in lowering the quality.
Yeah, and definitely also lowering their income. The advertising revenue of big tech companies have skyrocketed.
Yeah.
And at the same time, not unconnected, the advertising revenue for, let's say, traditional media has gone down. And as you say, there can be changed the business model. So in the kind of age or initial age of optimism around social media, I guess there was a bit of naivety about those platforms that were treated as a public space. And instead, now there's much more awareness that those are not public space. They are privately owned. They have their own agendas. They are kind of a profit making. And they have their own logics. And one of the effects that's been discussed the most that this business model is driving is polarization, right? So the idea is that through social media, people are more likely to find themselves in information bubbles. And because social media algorithms, they tend to amplify the more extreme, the more controversial views, as you were saying, to drive engagement, then this reinforces the impression that the other side is terrible, that we can't talk to them, that they are to be feared, and that kind of undermines the potential for compromise and, you know, democratic deliberation. Now, I would like to know what you think about this polarizing effect, but also I'd like to pick your brains on something else, which I think it's a separate effect and cannot be subsumed under polarization. And this is the fear that the way the algorithm works, it tends to suggest and promote content that is extreme, that might facilitate, let's say, accidental exposure to radical, often white supremacist content. And so it's in this way, the risk to me at least seems not only polarization and the society becomes divided, but that certain extreme positions are spread and perhaps normalized. Now, I know this is a relatively new area of research, both, you know, for you and in general, I think. But what do we know about this? And is the key risk here that a few particularly susceptible individuals might be radicalized, or that these extreme views become more normal for the general public?
Social media work, you know, everyone knows how social media work. We use a hashtag and use certain words and tag each other, and it's a big network. And the polarization literature measured, so what they're doing is to say how different are groups from each other, for example, in their opinions, or, you know, and how do social media kind of play into this difference and separating this, so polarizing these different potentially political groups, ideologies from each other. But then if you look at social media, how they work, they actually make networks. And we also know this. So this whole idea of accidental exposure, meaning that what you can actually do with social media is you create a new path. You say, well, this specific hashtag is connected to this, but it's also connected to something else. Charlotte will talk about this more, I'm sure, you know, the cottagecore discussion, where, you know, people are interested in certain lifestyle choices, look at that on Instagram and TikTok, and all of a sudden, they kind of get lured into these, at times, really, really strange, dark places on the internet, where you have all of a sudden very strange nature memes with old, very strange Nazi symbolism in there. The problem is that some of these symbols are, you know, you need to know a lot in order to know that the symbol is from that specific group that is co-opted. There's this overlap of different symbols, and at times people start getting dragged into this. I think I'm rambling a little bit because I'm still trying to figure this out, and I think both Charlotte and I, we started working on this a little bit, and we'll look into like what's out there. And there are a lot of things that you actually need to know the communities in order to identify them, and you need to know what kind of symbols they use in order to be aware what they mean. And I think that's the danger.
Yeah, I think there's this growing body of evidence that's showing that what seems like very positive or innocuous content online can lead you down a path to the radical rights, neo-Nazism, nationalist communities. And yeah, I've already mentioned this one project that I saw presented at a conference by Robin Olenek, I think, that was talking about a study that she had done on the cottagecore aesthetic on Instagram, which became very popular during COVID. And it's an aesthetic around natural living, homesteading, country gardens, the English cottage aesthetic. And that was during COVID. People felt a comfort in that in the context of lockdowns. But they did this study of cottagecore and related hashtags and found that what can happen is that you're led down a kind of pipeline on social media where you're gradually shown more and more related content from related hashtags that become extremely conservative and can even lead you down to white nationalism and neo-Nazi groups. So they talked about how there's an overlap with the tradwife phenomenon, which is this idea of like glorifying traditional gender roles in marriage. So the traditional wife who stays at home, looks after the house and the children and the cooking, does the kind of grows her vegetables and this kind of thing. This is all from American context, but I think there, particularly in the UK, there's quite a lot of overlap. And that in some of these cases, you can get then shown symbolism and content from like more explicitly white nationalist or neo-Nazi groups. And there's also amplified by other studies on, there's one from Catherine Tibaldi on granola Nazis, and that looks at the wellness and kind of communities that are very, very gendered, so that's kind of their women's kind of health communities that focus on natural health, natural medicine, organic food, but there's a strong overlap with anti-vaccine content. And then can, in some cases, send you down this kind of pipeline to neo-Nazi groups in the US. What we might think of as just kind of nice aesthetics on social media can become really quite dangerous.
Yeah, that's very interesting, because also, you know, in historical traditional fascism, you have this cult of the body and of nature. And so there can be kind of this kind of how the wellness industry or me kind of, you know, feeding my sourdough can be then harnessed to kind of create these paths. Then that doesn't mean that everybody follows the path. But as Brina was saying, that many people might like the instruments to understand that they're going into that path, and kind of that might kind of normalize certain types of content or like just kind of be consumed as part of, you know, one's diet of information about the world. So my final question for both of you, as we're coming to the end of the recording, is that how do we solve this? So I know that content moderation was thought as a solution, a viable solution. We haven't seen many results from there. And if, well, why not? But also, we've already talked about this is part of the business model, right? So social media platforms thrive from extreme content because that drives clicks, which drives engagement, which means that the more we engage, the more data about us is made available, about our preferences, our what makes us angry, what makes us tick, what makes us emotional, and then that data can be sold on. So if we're living in this age of what Shoshana Zuboff called a surveillance capitalism, how do we deal with the negative externalities of these businesses? So if it's not a bug, but it's a feature, is there a way out of this? Or is this the way social media is structured and our, you know, online public square is actually private and is driven by, say, priorities that are not the priorities of democracy?
I think, so depending on the time of the day you ask me this question, I have a different answer. I think I'm going to out myself as a pessimist. I don't think there's a solution to this. I think dealing with it is, you mentioned dealing with it is better. And I think, in a way, a nuanced, maybe a more nuanced answer, and then I have a super polemic answer. And I'm going to start with the nuanced answer. And then I do the polemic answer. And then Charlotte takes over and rectifies. In a way, if we think about all the stuff that's out there, the abundance of information, the amount of data that's out there, and the amount of data that is being monetized, speaking about Zuboff's surveillance capitalism concept. If you think about that, then it's a slippery slope to say we need government to regulate this, or that intermediaries, so social media companies themselves, need to be responsible for dealing with that content. Both in terms of social media companies, again, have their own interests. They thrive on data, they thrive on discourse, on imagery, on content, user-generated content, and governments are too slow to regulate this. And again, I'm a pessimist when it comes to this. There need to be more laws when it comes to content moderation or hate speech, and actually understanding that online violence is violence offline as well. So there has to be a reckoning, because when we start taking this much more seriously, again, I'm not a law expert, I'm not an expert in criminal law at all, but in terms of, you know, there's studies that look at how protected are people. They're hardly protected online. What do they do when they become the victims of abuse, of blackmailing? The police is not really able to do anything. So one measure could be to say, okay, governments provide more measures to control what's going on online, but then we are in a kind of dangerous direction that governments start controlling social media. So I don't think there's a way out. I think this is a new reality that we have to deal with, and that we have to kind of protect ourselves and each other with, and that in kind of like finding a new way in talking about freedom versus security, because this is, I find that very difficult to grasp. And I think the polemic one is basically that right now we don't even agree on what the problem is. So for that, I mean, do we want more security? Do we want more freedom? Freedom of speech a lot, especially in American context. We still don't agree on what the actual problem is. So I find it super hard to come up with solutions, because the society as a whole needs to come up with that. And potentially even transnationally, there need to be some kind of solutions, and also beyond the EU alone.
Yeah. Charlotte, are you a pessimist as well? Or can you close with an optimistic note?
I don't think I have any optimistic things to say, I'm afraid. I think the problem is capitalism. And I think what kind of frustrates me a little bit with a lot of the discussions around this is the focus is almost exclusively on social media companies. And I think that's important, and that they, you know, there needs to be better regulation of social media companies. I think it'll be really interesting to see what the EU Digital Services Act does, which has now come into force, but we're yet to really see the effects and how well it kind of manages to regulate the particularly the big social media companies. But if we start from the position that you actually social media is deeply intertwined with all aspects of our lives, and that we cannot really separate the online and the offline and the legacy media from the new media, then you can't just focus on social media platforms. You have to look at kind of regulating how all companies kind of engage with social media and bringing in guidelines for how governments engage with social media. So one thing that I've been working on, and particularly in the UK context, is around media regulation, where you have better regulation of the press that also incorporates or acknowledges that the new context in which the media is working, and around how journalists and editors use social media. I think it's also about how politicians and how governments use social media, because we do have instances of governments, and I mean, Donald Trump is a prime example of kind of how he used social media to stoke hatred, to spread disinformation. And so that's part of the problem. And I think then there's a wider issue when it comes to online abuse. I don't think content moderation can really work, because that's just a kind of sticking plaster, and that we need to address the kind of broader context of misogyny and racism in society. And that's like a much more difficult fix than just requiring Facebook to delete some comments.
I mean, content moderation as such is another issue, that who are the content moderators? Often they are outsourced somewhere. They're not being paid well. They have to deal with they have to see and read through these dark places on social media. And then to kind of like make democracy work, that's already another business model that I find really, really dangerous or critical, because we're just basically redoing everything that is kind of the problem. Charlotte mentioned capitalism is a problem. Your content moderation is also based on that. And then, you could say, well, don't we use AI to find content moderation? And that would be super great if AI would work this way. But unfortunately, it's built by people who have, bias and everything. So, I mean, that's a whole other podcast episode, I guess, but content moderation as such is insufficient.
Yeah, this is not the solution, I think.
So I'm afraid we come to the end of this, so we'll leave the AI conversation to the next podcast recording. Thanks a lot for what I think was an illuminating conversation. I want to thank you both, Charlotte and Verena, for joining the People Power Politics podcast, and for talking to us about social media and democracy, or social media in democracy, with democracy. I am Licia Cianetti, Deputy Director of CEDAR and the host of this People Power Politics podcast episode. I have been talking to Charlotte Galpin, Senior Lecturer at the University of Birmingham, and Verena Brandl, Assistant Professor also at the University of Birmingham. Thank you. Thank you for listening to the People Power Politics podcast, brought to you by CEDAR, the Centre for Elections, Democracy, Accountability and Representation at the University of Birmingham. To learn more about our centre and the exciting work we do on these issues around the world, please follow us on Twitter at CEDAR_BHAM and visit our website using the link in the podcast description.